Hello, everyone. Great to see you all. As Joa pointed out on various points on the map, and yet all together on this screen in front of me. And in today's world, that's heartwarming. To find comrades. This afternoon I ran into someone in the street, someone who is in town for the retreat at Donna next door that starts tonight. And we chatted and then went on our ways or something. And for some reason we said, we were reminded that we've known each other for almost 30 years, 28 years. And she said, isn't it amazing that we're still doing this? And I said, yeah, it's fabulous that we're still doing this. How fortunate. And I don't really know how to define what this is we're doing, but it's this. It's coming together and our hearts meet around the joys and sufferings of our worlds. And the world today, it's a challenge. With the constant deepening and spinning of the turmoil and the violence and suffering that just seems unending, and that we're all affected by in our various corners of the planet, even if we don't think about it 24/7. We do think about it and we do feel it and we hurt for it in different ways. And we may feel powerless, we may feel angry, we may feel sad. We may not want to think about it. We may be addicted to thinking about it, following the news all the time. So as this has been part of my life as well. I've returned to the peacemaker, the Zen peacemaker, three tenets, which are not knowing, meaning giving up ideas, fixed ideas about myself and others in the world. That's not an easy one. Especially when we're confronted with something that we feel so strongly about, when it seems so clear that something is right and wrong and good and bad. So I've tried to stay with that one, not knowing, which then allows me to more easily practice the second one, which is bearing witness. Bearing witness to the joys and sufferings of the world. Bearing witness in the sense of just receiving, paying attention, being present to the joys and suffering of the world. So not only the suffering, we can get caught by that we only pay attention to the horrors. The newspapers are, and the news programs are filled with bad news, and we miss things that are heartwarming as well. And if I've given up my fixed ideas and I can open my heart to just being with things here and now, I then have a better possibility of acting appropriately, which is the third tenet. Acting from a place of no fixed ideas and seeing the whole picture and the tiniest little picture in front of me. And acting accordingly, which used to be translated as taking loving action, but loving is maybe too charged a word, and we may have difficulty letting go of our ideas about what that means, and we may not be able to act. Bernie Glassman used to give the example of if our arm is full of gangrene, you know, a terrible infection, I think it's probably the same word in Portuguese and in French, gangrene. You know, we might have to remove the arm. It doesn't seem like a loving action, but it might be what's necessary to save the body, to save the life. So when we say loving action, it may be too charged. It's appropriate action according to the circumstance. And we're all asking ourselves in the world today, what can I do? What should I do? What's the best thing to do? And we feel powerless. So in order to answer, when people ask me that question, when I receive people, students, and I hear what they're saying, and almost everyone is talking about this, of course, whether in Zen students or in my writing workshops or elsewhere, family, friends, I've taken this practice, made it my own so that I can better respond when it's raised in this situation with others. And this afternoon I went out for a walk. I think last Thursday I talked about my walk as well. I guess Thursday afternoon is when I have some time and I go out for a walk. And it was a beautiful day here in Paris. Fabulous spring, beautiful sunlight, not too cold, just really beautiful day. And I went out on my walk and I took a different way, like I said last week, to see it differently, to really try to not know and bear witness. And as I was coming along the path in the park, up ahead, I saw this little tiny girl, you know, maybe 18 months old, two maximum, you know, just learning to speak. I would say 18 months probably. And was there, and her mother, she was with her mother, or someone who looked like her mother, and with a young woman. And the little girl was standing on the path and she was saying in French, but she was saying, look, look, as best she could. You know, it was in French, it was garde, garde. It was like only part of the word instead of regarde, regarde. It was garde, garde. And pointing into the under the trees. And there was a crow, a big crow there. And my thought was, I thought, oh, that was so sweet. And the crow, the little girl and the crow were almost the same size. Although the crow was far away, it wasn't like going to hurt her. It wasn't really even paying any attention to her. And I thought, wow, the little girl doesn't seem afraid of that bird. And the bird was like almost as big as her. And her mother didn't seem to be paying any attention. And as I got closer, I saw that her mother was on the phone. And the little girl just kept, you know, gar, look, look. And then when I got almost to the mother, the mother ended her phone call and immediately shouted at the little girl and said, don't look at that. On s'en fout in French, which means, you know, like, who cares? you know, nobody cares. And she said, it's ugly, it's mean, it's a crow. Let's go look at the sheep. It really harshly, really, really harshly, and it just broke my heart because this little girl was so enthralled with this crow. And suddenly here's her mother telling her, don't look at that. Huge judgment of it's ugly, it's mean. And in French, on s'en fout is like really strong. It's like, you know, who cares? You know, who gives a shit? To say to a small child like that was really wow. And I walked on, like, you know, painfully. And as I walked a few more steps up ahead, there was another little girl with an older woman who I quickly realized was this woman's other daughter and probably with the grandmother, you know, up ahead. And there was a woman with a little dog, you know, one of these tiny little, you know, I don't even know what those dogs are called, but like a Yorkshire Terrier or something. One of those little dogs, very sweet, tiny little dogs. And on a leash, and this little girl wanted to pet the dog. And the mother, who was behind me and had just told her daughter not to look at the crow, screamed, stop touching the dog. Arrête de toucher le chien. It was like really, really harsh. And the woman who had the dog on the leash was really kind and was saying, it's a really sweet dog. You can just pet him this way, you know, pet his fur in this direction. He'll be really happy. And the dog seemed happy, you know. And I kept walking in. I thought, wow, we're so far from not knowing, bearing witness and loving action, you know. And it was as if suddenly this was a teaching of how the world gets to how it is today, you know, because at a very young age, we learn this kind of thing. People tell us not to look at that, maybe not in such a harsh way, but we learn at a very young age what we should look at and what we shouldn't look at, what is considered worthy and what isn't. Often it has to do with ourselves. You know, it's often it's the adult telling us, don't be that way. Don't be you. Be like that person or be like that this. Don't pay any attention to the thing we always say, you know, a child falls down, hurts its knee or something, and the adult immediately says, it's nothing, it's nothing. Have a piece of candy. It's nothing. The child's crying, hurt, fell down, and the adult says, it's nothing. It's nothing. It's okay. It's nothing. So we learn to not pay attention. We learn to look away. We learn to then make these big divisions on what's good and what's not, what we should look at. So the little girl is learning, you don't look at a bird, or you don't look at what your mother tells you not to look at. And then that develops, and it's certain people you don't look at, certain people you don't want to include, certain activities, certain foods, certain ways of being, a lot of rejecting we do, and fixing on other things. So this grasping and pushing away is really starts really, really young. It was tragic, you know. I guess because I was so in this, you know, not knowing, bearing witness and taking loving action and applying that to the horrors of the Ukraine situation, or the climate crisis, or you name it, you know, there's how many things are we facing today that are we can apply this to? And here, everywhere I looked, it was there. Now, I kept walking because that was the appropriate action. It would not have been appropriate for me to intervene in a situation like that. At least not on a Thursday afternoon out for my afternoon walk. And, it would be like, well, lady, mind your own business. The mother probably would have shouted at me, probably insultingly and whatever. It didn't matter. I kept walking, and I the fact that it touched me and that I took it to my heart was enough. And so then I started looking around. There were other parents with children, and there were people with dogs. There were younger people among themselves. There were a bunch of young boys playing football and really rough and pushing each other and whatever. But it didn't have that same character of the mother, violently telling her child not to what to look at. And I didn't notice any other parents doing that either. At the same time, like I said, we all, to some extent, have learned this way. And we see where it leads us to a place of the other is bad. There are things we want, and we stop at nothing to get them. We don't pay attention to others' needs, or we don't pay attention to the joys. Like I said, we focus a lot on the suffering. We don't pay attention to the joys. This mother was not paying attention to her little girl's joy in that situation. Probably because no one was paying attention to her joy when she was a little girl. And the funny, it was funny because when she was talking on the phone, as I approached and she was saying goodbye, she said bisou to the person on the phone, which is, kisses. So she was affectionate with whoever it was on the phone, and then to her daughter, really. So that too, we selectively, we pick and choose. Tibetan Buddhists practice from a place of the world in which every living being in the world was at some point in time your mother, because they so believe in the interconnection and reincarnation that everything is your mother. And that changes how they move in the world and how they act. Because we all know, maybe we have hard difficulties with our mother, but we do treat our mother differently than we treat some other lady that we're sitting across from in the metro. Or, the woman behind the cash register at the supermarket. We treat our mother, we have a different relationship with our mother. So if we can extend that, our care to every living being, what a different world it would be, wouldn't it? Now, when we hear this, we think, oh, that's impossible. I can't possibly do that. Forget it. I can't do that. But it's like our vow where we say, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. It doesn't mean we're going to save them all. And I don't like that word save. I have to figure out a change of words for that. But what that means is that each one So everyone I meet is valid, is worthy being seen. So like with this Ukraine situation, you don't have to go to the front lines. You don't have to go to the Polish border with your car and drive people back to France, or it doesn't require any grandiose action. It requires just where you are in your life, in your community, in your family. How do you make peace? And that's where this practice of not knowing, bearing witness, and taking appropriate action is really powerful. Because it's something you can carry in your pocket and apply it every moment. It might move you to, donate to the Red Cross, or it might move you to connect with the Ukrainian community and see what you can do. It might be something like that, but really probably not. It probably will be just listening to others, because everyone's talking about it. Everyone's being affected by it. Listening to yourself, how you're feeling, how can you move in the world? How can you not feed anger, aggression, suffering? How can you not further that in the world? How can you refrain from harm, limit the harm that you do? Because if everyone does that, then we don't end up with these situations. And it's really, this morning I had a writing workshop in which the theme and the texts didn't have anything to do with Ukraine. The theme was, in French, éphémère, the ephemeral, things that are ephemeral. All the texts people were writing in the workshop were really, really heavy stuff. You know, people dying and loss, someone with Alzheimer's. It was all really heavy stuff. And they remarked on it, the people in the group. They said, wow, you know, we're all writing such heavy stuff. And they said, next week, can we do something funny? You know, can we write like funny stuff? And I said, you know, usually, I mean, ephemeral isn't necessarily, in fact, it's not heavy. You know, it's like soap bubbles. It's like light. It's weightless, ephemeral. You know, it's like clouds or feathers, or, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's not by nature heavy. So I helped them to see that it was what was coming out in their writing was really coming from what they're all confronting in the world. And I don't know if it was healing. The intention of these workshops is not healing. It's not art therapy. You know, I don't know if it was. I think it was... This is what I've noticed in all the groups, even, you know, like in the study group, even when we've met and talked. I think it really is the coming together in times like this is really important. I'm just expressing whatever's happening, whatever you're feeling. And so I think that was probably healing. Just that to say that... this is like with COVID, this is another example of like so clear of interconnection of our world. Because most of us, we have nothing to do with Ukraine or Russia. But we do. We have everything to do with Ukraine and Russia. Whether it's, you know, now gas, Whether it's, you know, maybe somebody knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, or you had, you know, so I'm surprised at how many people I've encountered who have, ancestors, great-grandfather or someone who fled Ukraine. It's really surprising that people have connections. Direct, but even indirect. In fact, there is probably no indirect. It's just, it seems to us farther away, our connections. But we're all connected, so we're all affected. We all are Ukraine. We all are Russia. We don't like to think that one, but we are. So that's another, I should call these talks stories from my walks. Now I would like to hear if any of you have anything to say, if you'd like to ask questions or comments, share. Well,
good evening, everyone. I feel it's really beautiful when I'm able to bear witness to the joys and sufferings, in that, from that perspective of not knowing, it might seem strange to use this word beautiful, but it's the seeing clearly that I find beautiful. Just wanted to share that feeling. Thank you.
I'd like to share the fact that since this war has started, I have found myself, I found that it was extremely difficult not to have strong opinions, I found it hard not to be filled with reactivity about what was going on, lots of judgments and righteousness, who is right and who is wrong. I found it very difficult not to be carried away by what was going on, and And I really had to, felt I had to, once again, like with Trump, being extremely cautious to be really the gatekeeper of my senses, so that I don't get carried away too much with what's going on. Really, I felt that extremely challenging. And just even this sense of a very a question, I've questioned a lot this sense of righteousness. And very easy to fall into the, oh yeah, right. It's just the obvious illustration of greed, anger, and ignorance, what's going on. And so I know better, basically. And I find it hard to resist that temptation to just feel that, yeah, he's wrong, I'm right, and I know what's good.
Yeah, I think we can probably all relate with that and recognize ourselves doing that, and that's the importance of that first tenet of not knowing, you know, trying to let go of those fixed ideas. And it's not easy. And it doesn't mean not having opinions. You know, that's the tricky thing. We think, oh, then I can't have any opinion. But that's not what it means. It means just not clinging to it. Like Joe said, you know, not having this righteous, I'm on my high horse. It's not clinging to it, you know, trying to just not be fixed there. Debbie?
But it's not easy. I was coming out, there's a wonderful old man who lives down at the bottom of my street. He used to have a taxi phone place, but he's now 80 plus and he's decided that he's retiring. So he just kind of hangs out. And every time he sees me coming, he goes and gets a paddle. And he pretends like he's going to paddle me. We have a very kind of love-hate relationship. And he is of the opinion that Putin is a victim of Western propaganda. And I've had other moments with him where something's going on and he's on the totally opposite end of the spectrum of what I think. And he started the other night, I just had a conversation about the real world. And all of a sudden I met him on the street and he did this thing, we're going to box and everything. And all of a sudden he began his defense of Putin, and my heart is always completely, there are two sides to me. This man is such a doll. Everybody on the street loves him. He's our old sort of mayor of the street. And at the same time, he's always telling me things that I can't bear to hear. It's such an odd sensation, but it pricked my head because he believes what he's saying. Just the way I believe what I'm saying. And I like him. Oh.
Yeah, and that's you should consider yourself lucky you can consider yourself lucky that you do have contact with someone instead of, because we tend to just kind of circulate in our own little thing where everybody agrees with what we think, more or less. And that's a great opportunity. You know? Someone was telling me, one of my colleagues, writing workshop colleagues, that there's this, you know, one of the leading Ukrainian authors today, Andrei Kurkov, I don't know if anyone's heard of him. And in one of his books that she's reading, it takes place in a village in Ukraine somewhere. And there's these two old guys. One of them lives on Lenin Street. The name of the street is Lenin. And the other one lives on Shevchenko Street. And Shevchenko, Taras Shevchenko, is like the national poet of Ukraine. I think Seu mentioned him last week, or at one point Seu mentioned him. He has statues, like apparently there's more statues of Taras Shevchenko in the world than of Jesus. And I think Seu said there's one in Lisbon, right? Or something, or some monument.
Yes.
Anyway, so one of these old guys lives on Lenin Street and the other one lives on Shevchenko Street. And one of them is pro ex-Soviet Union and Russia. And he's the one who lives on Lenin Street. And the other one is pro-independent Ukraine. And he's the one who lives on Shevchenko Street. And they're like lifelong friends, but they're enemies. And they live on these opposing streets. And I guess in the story, it's kind of probably a fable or something, but they end up, they're the last two people in the village. And so what are they going to do? Like not speak to each other? I don't know actually what happens in the story, but it's like frenemies, you know, and that's actually quite beautiful, you know, that can we disagree about things and yet still be friends? Or still, you know, you say you love this guy to death, and but you don't agree with him politically. So it's actually quite a precious situation. An opportunity to listen and to bear witness. And what's his name, the guy?
Monsieur Abbas.
Oh, I remember seeing Monsieur Abbas, yeah.
Monsieur, I don't think I even know his first name. He's been on that street for 25, 30 years. Because there's some young people that have one of these modern hair salon sort of things. And they're a little bit rough looking and they have tattoos and things. I said, are you afraid of them? He said, nah, I saw them when they were knee-high to a grasshopper. I'm not afraid of anybody. And he's not. He is our mayor. I've decided, in my case, I've decided to let him be right. I'm sure that he has not come to the same decision. He wants to set me straight. But I have decided I like him too much. Also, I can't. How can you argue with somebody who's convinced that Putin is a victim? What can I say? He's a victim of the West. And also, he used to call me Obama. Then when he started calling me Trump, we had to quit that. This was very precious. I mean, it's a very intense emotional moment when we get into these, because I can see my affection for him for winning out in the end, although I'm very shocked every time. Mm-hmm. He always has positions I'd never imagined anybody I knew would ever have. Mm.
What you're saying, Debbie, just reminds me, I don't know exactly know how it's related, but it's on the question of how do we connect. I just heard today that some Russian soldiers got captured by the Ukrainians. And the story, I think it was on the BBC, I don't know where I heard that. The first thing that the Russian soldiers are talking about is that they start talking about their mothers as if it would be something that might touch the Ukrainians. And it's really interesting that this is really what, I mean, as human beings, beyond political ideas, like we're humans and we all have, we all do understand what it is to have parents and to love your mother and your father. And trying to connect on that level of humanity so that we're able to connect with one another.
And yeah. Also, excuse
me. Rather than what separates us. Yeah. Go ahead, Debbie. Yeah.
I also saw, Joe, I don't know if you all have seen this, that the Ukrainians lend them a telephone so that they can call their mothers.
Hmm.
There's some situation in which they, because they understand how important it is for these boys to be in touch. Yeah?
Hmm.
Hi everyone.
Hello.
When I read this, watch the news, I wonder sometimes what the Russian soldiers think about all of this. You know, I have no idea, but I wonder if they agree or disagree, or if they have opinions about this and how they deal with what they have to do. You know, that's a thought that strikes me. Comes to my mind also.
Yeah, and seeing them as individuals. I know, having grown up in the United States, pretty much brainwashed about Russians and the Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe, because I grew up during the Cold War, and when I first came to Europe and I was in Amsterdam, you know, partying, and in my youth hostel, there were these girls from Yugoslavia. It was still Yugoslavia in those days. And for me, Yugoslavia was behind the Iron Curtain. It wasn't actually, but for an American kid, you know, raised on American propaganda, Yugoslavia was east, you know, behind the Iron Curtain. And it was like, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and these Yugoslav girls were in the room, like, you know, just getting wasted on vodka and smoking hash. And I was just like, whoa, these girls are just like me. I mean, not that I was sitting there drinking vodka and smoking hash at 3 in the afternoon, but it, you know, suddenly they weren't just like these, I don't know, you know, faceless robot people or bad guys or something. And we started talking with them, and I think I asked something, you know, so naive and silly. It was like, how did you get here? You know? And they were like, well, we took the train. So, you know, it's a good point, you know, let's see these soldiers as like human beings, and, you know, they have mothers too, and they have lives, and they have opinions, and they're just doing their what they're asked to do. The soldiers are like that everywhere. And yet each one is an individual, you know. Claudia.
Hello, everybody. It's funny what, it's not funny, but what Joa just said, because since I'm watching the news, I mean, when I'm reading the news about Ukraine, I'm really wondering what does it mean to be a mother in a war? I mean, and going through a war, I think I can leave it as a individual or as a personal level. I can imagine what it can be, but I cannot imagine what it can be to be a mother. As a matter of fact, this is the first thing that really worries me. What do you do? I mean, at any age, what do you decide for your kids? And okay, so but I can see that. That's why that when Joa said that for the soldier and to ask to propose them to call their mother, there is really something with the parenting in the story.
Yeah, indeed. And the mothers who have to leave their sons who are 18 years old and aren't allowed to leave. Or who have babies. Someone was telling me, Manon, who some of you know, who I don't think she would mind me telling the story, but she's a pediatrician in a hospital in Germany. And yesterday a Ukrainian mother came in, a woman who had escaped from Ukraine and had made it to southern Germany where Manon lives because she had some acquaintance who lived there or something. And she had three children and she came in with her little baby who had a high fever and was not well. So this touches what Claudia says, you know, here's this woman with three small children, came with only what she had on her back and had what she could carry and had to leave the father behind. And the child is sick. She's lucky. She was able to get to somewhere, have somewhere to stay. She was able to get to a hospital. They kept the baby. Manuel said the baby will be fine. They're keeping it overnight. It's just, you know, but it's true. And there's, you know, millions of stories like that. Millions. And the mothers of the Russian soldiers as well. Or the mothers in Russia who, you know, they're living in a really uncertain situation as well. Not because there's an army invading, but because they're, you know, being cut off from the rest of the world, at least the Western world. So yeah, we can each find a way into our hearts with it, you know, whatever the entry is. There's the koan of Joshu, who, you know, someone said, what's the Dharma, or what are the Dharma gates? I don't forget something about how do we enter the Dharma or something. And he says, East gate, West gate, North gate, South gate. It's like every direction is an entry. Everything is an entry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello. I was just, it's very sad about what's going on around the world. But one thing that I can say, it's like really beautiful to see how people around the world are sending help. And I'm seeing Ukrainian flags, you know, even in a small town that you would never even know that they're aware of what's going on in the world. It's amazing. It's beautiful, actually, as hard as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's out of this, you know, out of this nettle danger, we pluck this flower, compassion and heart, and yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I wanted to add that what we're talking about and what we've discussed is just resonates for me as the manifestation of the fact that this practice is a practice of caring and this loving action. And it's like, it's not just sitting on a cushion and contemplating the air coming in and out of our nostrils, but it's really how do we relate with one another? And this is the path of the Bodhisattva, and it's broad, it's fast, and it's inclusive.
Yeah, I guess that's when, you know, when I saw Helen in the street this afternoon and she said, oh, we've been doing this for almost 30 years. That's what we've been doing, you know? That's what we've been doing. It's wonderful. There's nothing else I would rather be doing, actually. I'm so happy that you're doing it too. No, that's part of it, is it? Because when I started out on this path, I was all alone and I didn't know anybody. And part of the reason I sought out a teacher was because I wanted to know other people. I wanted to share this with other people.
It's like the George Harrison song. It talks about unfolding love. It's about unfolding love.
If it's true, as I always say, it's all about love. And if we come back to then, okay, so what do we do? You know, come back to your cushion and not knowing, bearing witness, and seeing what arises. Because we do need something to hang on to, you know, when we need some kind of structure in our approach. We just say, oh, it's about love. But that can become a concept very easily. So, thank you. I guess we will do the four vows. I remind you, study group on Saturday, and the following Saturday, a day of practice. I guess Lisa will send out a doodle at some point, sign up at some point. After that, we have... Well, then we're coming into April when we have two retreats. So I think it's possible to register if you're in Portugal or you want to come to the Portuguese retreat at the end of April. It's possible to register. If you want to come to Belgium, I don't think anyone here is interested apart from people who have signed up. There's still a bit of place there. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you for being here and sharing.